Hi, everybody. Welcome to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly podcast. We provide perspectives on leadership. Today, we're excited to welcome Amelia Dunlap. She's the author of the new book, Elevating the Human Experience, Three Paths to Love and Worth at Work. Amelia is the Chief Experience Officer at Deloitte Digital and leader of the U.S. Customer Strategy and Applied Design Practice for Deloitte Consulting. She helps companies develop winning strategies that combine innovation, creativity, and digital strategy. She's passionate about elevating the human experience and exploring how organizations can connect with the humans whom they call customers and employees. Amelia speaks and publishes frequently on the topic of the human experience, strategy, and innovation. She received Consulting Magazine's Top Woman in Technology Award for Excellence in Innovation in 2020. She holds a degree in sociology from Harvard, a master's in theology from Boston College, and an MBA from Cambridge University. So, gosh, thanks for being here. I know you're doing Yeah, I know you're doing a lot of these and to promote your book, and it's a pleasure to have you. And so I read your bio. Tell us a little about how you came to writing the book and how you came to this work.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. So let's see, I guess maybe I would start by saying about 4 years ago, we set an aspiration to elevate the human experience. And I'll tell you, Sue, we didn't really know what that meant at the time, but we had this sense that it was more than just about showing up as a customer or showing up as an employee, that there was a much more human way to kind of show up, and that a lot of organizations had somehow kind of forgotten that. And so we just had this idea of really focusing on what would better look like what could we do to make each experience just a little bit more human, a little bit better. And that's kind of what started this whole role around sort of being a chief experience officer, and then led to the book of the same name, right? Elevating the Human Experience. But I would say that, as you probably know, that there's a lot of me in this book, because I felt like if we're going to talk about what it means to have a human experience, not only do I want it to be well-researched, but I felt like it had to be a bit more personal and a bit more human. Sure. So there's, you know, I feel like I put a lot of my own sort of vulnerability and life story in the book as well.
That's great. Yeah, there's definitely some great stories in there. So the book is called Elevating the Human Experience, Three Paths to Love and Worth at Work. And so I want to hear from you a little bit about like how you define love and how you define worth. And as you're talking about that, I just want to say, I think it's great you're talking about it. I think that talking about love at work is not something normally we do. And if there's ever a time in our, you know, lifetimes we shouldn't be talking about it, it's probably right now. So talk a little bit about how you defining those two terms, and we'll move from there.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. So I mean, I agree that even just using the word love and worth at work feels a little bit risky, a little bit provocative. But I felt like, first of all, I wanted to be deliberately provocative and talk about love and worth, because when I thought about writing a book, I wanted to make sure it's a topic that I would want to spend that much time with, and would be that meaningful. I'm a strategist, I'm an innovator, I'm a marketer, but I thought about like, what would I actually want to spend 200 pages with? And for me, that felt like the fundamental human need to feel loved and to feel worthy, even when we show up at work, felt like it was really important. So that's a little bit about the why. In terms of how I think about the definition of love, I feel like it goes back to the Greek word eudaimonia, where the Greeks have seven different words to our one for the word love. And eudaimonia really means flourishing. And who wouldn't want to flourish in the context of our work? And so then for the definition that I use in the book, also builds on Eric Fromm back in the 1950s. He talked in The Art of Loving. So I define love as the choice that we make to extend ourselves for either our own or another's growth. It's very kind of growth oriented towards this idea of flourishing. So that's how I think about love. And the reason, one of the things I like about it is with that definition, you can do like, oh, right, love is present at work, right? It's, we don't necessarily talk about it as much, but what would it look like for us to make it more present and kind of more kind of part of our normal discourse? And then the worth part of that is I did some research with 6,000 people in the United States across all different sort of walks of life and all different types of employment. And there was many things that we learned. The thing that most surprised me was that 9 out of 10 people said to them that it mattered to feel worthy, but about half, you know, myself included, struggle at times to feel worthy, particularly in a work context. You kind of like, wait a second, if it's so important to us and it matters so much, why are we struggling? And so I call that gap, the worthiness gap. And so it's really just this idea of intrinsic worth, which is before we do or say anything, that we have that fundamental kind of human need to feel like we are seen, we are valued, and we are heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, feeling worthy at work is, I mean, it's gotta be top, I don't know, one or two or three for sure in terms of why people stay or go for sure. I'm sure you have data on that too.
Well, I mean, actually the reason I'm nodding and smiling because we all know that we're, whether you want to call it the great resignation or the great reflection or whatever it is, we are all kind of really thinking pretty hard.
Yeah.
Right. About the fact that we work now more than any other culture and more than any other time in history. And now it seems like, you know, not just working from home, but living at work. And so we want our work to mean something and we want to feel like it's, you know, it's a place where we can feel loved and worthy. So I do think it's, you know, it's a timely conversation.
Is it, a meaning, I think, having meaning at work, I mean, it's certainly different from worthy, but it's certainly, I think they're tied for sure. Finding meaning is going to be tied to being feeling worthy. Yes or no?
No, it's true. So I reflected a lot on that in the book too. And there's a little anecdote that I love I can share with you, which is my daughter, who at the time was 8 years old, I was putting her to bed one night and she said, you know, Mama, what is the meaning of life? And like my first thought was like, okay, hold on. What shows have you been watching on Netflix that you have these like big life questions when you're 8 years old, right? Like clearly I got to like monitor your consumption of media at this point. And then my other thought was like, okay, well, you know, this is one of those parenting moments, right? This really matters. Don't F this one up, right? But I just said to her that I feel like the question of a meaningful life is, you know, worth living your life to kind of answer. But I can tell you my answer is that meaning is found through the connecting with people who we love, who love us.
Exactly my answer too. And it was one of those things. I don't think anyone's ever, oh my God, I just say my answer is connection. It's like, that's just my answer. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. Okay, great.
Well, and also we can find connection to ourselves. We can find connection to another being, to a higher purpose, to, you know, meaningful work. Like, but yeah, there's something about connectedness that is where I think we find meaning. And so we can find absolutely a lot of meaning in the work that we do.
Right. So your book, you mentioned there's 6,000 people, 6,000, right, that you interviewed or did research with. So tell us a little bit more.
About it was a quantitative study of 6,000. And then we also did ethnographic interviews for about 30 people in depth.
Okay, great. So tell us about the data. So we can start with self-love and self-worth. Why don't we start with those? And what does the data tell us?
Well, I think I had hypotheses going in about what I expected to find in terms of differences between men and women or differences between different kind of intersecting identities. One of the things I was surprised is that there wasn't actually that big a difference in the need to feel loved or the need to feel worthy between men and women, for example. So I had anticipated there might've been, but there really wasn't. Hmm. But the places where the data did show some things that I thought were pretty interesting were in the ability to speak to ourselves with words of kindness and the self-love, as you talked about it. And that's where I was definitely surprised that people who identified as Black or African-American were far more likely to have this language of self-love and this language of sort of self-kindness than, you know, any other kind of racial identity groups. And, you know, I had to dig into that one because it was a little counterintuitive. And so when I did the ethnographic interviews and I spoke to a number of people, they told me that in a world that, you know, may not be reinforcing that you are lovable and you are worthy and kind of handing you more and more and more privileges, if you don't have that voice of self-love and self-kindness, you're not going to get it from anywhere else.
Right. Right.
So I feel like we can learn a lot.
I think I mean, you could write a whole book on that. That's people who are more self-loathing is almost a privileged position to do that. Yeah, I see that. That's actually really interesting. Okay,
but it's also, I think for me, it demonstrated that it's learnable, right? Sure. I mean, so even having this conversation, I say this at some point in my book, that the idea that you would, you know, say, hey, you know, Sue, how was your weekend? And you'd say, well, you know, it was good. I spent some time figuring out how to love myself. It's like, no, that's weird, right? We don't talk about that. We don't talk about teaching our children, what does it mean to love yourself? What does it mean to be proud of yourself and not need all these external validations in order to feel okay?
Right. Great. That's awesome. Before we get into how this is related to COVID and the pandemic and hybrid and the Great Resignation and all those things, I want to just give the foundation for you talk about three paths to love and worth. And so talk about those three paths, self, another, and community.
Yeah.
And then we'll get into like how it's applied to the now.
Absolutely. So I'll say what my training in, I have a master's in theology, and I did,
yeah, I saw that.
I did a lot of work with Hegel and his whole sort of school of thought. But so it's three paths, because I really truly believe that the first path is when we walk alone, right? We live inside our heads. We have the voice inside our heads that may or may not be kind to us and may or may not be loving. And so there's actually a lot of work I know I had to do, I continue to do, and many of us have to do about the narratives that we tell and the stories that we tell ourselves before anyone shows up and says something negatively or positively for on our behalf. So it's the work we do for ourselves to feel loved and worthy. Then the second path is that journey of another, where we have friends and mentors and sponsors and benefactors, and we are those things to other people. And how can we more consciously build those connections so that we see in another the worth that they see in themselves? And that I talk about as mirrored worth, where we can play it back to another person very consciously as an ally. And then that third path is the whole community of work, where we're going to come across hundreds, thousands of people who we may or may not have deep interactions with every day, but how do we create those spaces where people feel like they can show up with their authentic selves?
In thinking about those three paths, let's really focus, and we'll get people to participate here in a second here, but I want to talk a little bit about hybrid and remote work. And I mean, any of it really we can talk about, but there's sort of two things going on right now. There's a lot of people that aren't, in my world in tech, there's a lot of people that aren't going back to work yet. And there's this waiting thing, like things are going to be going back to normal at some point. We keep pushing back the dates, which we're going to keep pushing back the dates for a long time, I think, because this thing is going to be a pandemic for a while, and it's going to become an epidemic, and it's not going to go away because we can't get, you know, enough herd immunity, essentially. So given that we're going to be in what you're in, a lot of us, where, you know, you can go into the office sometimes, and in your case, Deloitte, you've got to be vaccinated in New York. And there's still going to be some of that going on. There's going to be some of, and there's also the connections issues with that, because even if you're in the office, you still have your mask on some of the times, or some people don't, you're still on Zoom. And then there's that situation. Then there's also the situation of like, there's people just going to be on Zoom all the time, or whatever, video on all the time. So both those situations, are problematic as far as connection. So talk about this. Like, here we are trying to talk about love and worth, and then we're trying to talk about like the ways we were connecting human to human in real life have now been essentially thrown out. Essentially. Right. So talk a little bit about that phenomenon. Yeah,
what I'll say is I actually a couple of years ago, Sue, I actually wrote an article on something that I called at the time human experience debt.
Yeah.
And it was this idea that we have technical debt, right, in our organizations, where we have these old legacy systems and we have to pay down that debt. Or we have financial debt, where we all know what that's like, both as a country and as an individual. But I think we are also been developing this human experience debt, where we create a piece of technology, we use some AI because we can. And it takes a little while to think through, like, oh, what's the fullness of the implications and of the experience of what it means to be human when we use all this technology? And the example there I like to give is, it's a very simple one, but when we all have these, you know, virtual assistants in our homes, and our children are barking orders to this device, and I'm kind of like pointing, are they learning what it means to say please and thank you? Do they have the a more human interaction in terms of how they get their needs satisfied? And so it's just those very subtle ways in which really thinking about how are we creating more or less human connectedness.
So then
you kind of flash forward to kind of where we are now, and you're not asking me to predict the future, but if I do kind of look ahead and if I think about it, that I think what we are all in right now is just a period of intentionality, right? Where if you want to see a loved one, if you want to see a friend, if you want to see a colleague, you have to be pretty intentional about it.
That's right.
Where are you going to meet? What do they feel safe meeting? Are the protocols? So I think we have to be very intentional. And I think that the hardest part with the intentionality is the new relationships. It's much easier to maintain a relationship digitally or by phone than it is to make a new one. And so I found, particularly in the workplace, actually I did 3 just today, very short, 20 or 30 minute conversations where it would have been a hallway chat. It would have been a kitchen chat. It would have been coffee chat, where it just try to kind of connect with and get to know people, even though we're not going to bump into each other ever. Right. So I think we do have to be more intentional is one thing I think.
That's
about.
A great point. Yeah.
We play it forward. I think we also have to be deliberately a little bit more human. Right. So I've often think about the idea that now that, in not all circumstances do we have to wear this professional mask anymore. So we've seen into each other's homes. So like, let's not have that professional facade. Like, let's actually acknowledge we're human beings. A kid could walk by at any point, because that's just, that's actually more normal than to think of people as these sort of robot workers in a corporate environment. And
people's humanity, like the Amazon person is going to come any minute here, I think, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So we have, a lot more empathy for that.
Yeah.
And then I guess like my final thing is just that if I play it forward, I do think that this format where we can see each other digitally is just one of the variations of what we'll have. I mean, the next one obviously is we're going to have this conversation in the metaverse, right? Where my avatar will be speaking to your avatar. What's that human experience going to look like? And I hope we don't have all of our meetings in the metaverse, but it'll be an option, right? And what does that look like?
I think that's going to be here like before we know it, 2 years. Will be in virtual.
So that's my predicting the future, that the video aspect as well as the metaverse will be just other modes and other channels, but they won't entirely replace the need to get together in person on occasion.
Right. So so that we could talk about the kids, because you have a 15 year old and 13, 11, 9, but 15. So we're in the same boat as far as like what's happening with them. But I want to talk about on this idea of not bumping into each other. So I've written and we've spent a lot of time talking about the virtual water cooler and the idea of lingering and like being intentional about like picking up the phone or even slacking somebody right after a big meeting. So like you're trying to like, walk your person next to the next meeting, even though you can't.
Right.
So this idea of lingering, I'd like you to comment on that in terms of how we, as a way to stay connected and what are some other ways we can be intentional, and how do we get people to be intentional?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I love the idea of lingering, right?
Yeah.
And it's a great way to put it, because it does require, it does imply a certain kind of human aspect of there's not, the meeting's over, right? Like the content or the show or whatever it was has happened, but
it's transactional usually too.
So I love the idea of lingering, and what does it mean to kind of create more lingering in our lives? So that's a good thing to reflect on. I'm trying to think. I don't know. I feel like lingering is the hardest thing to do digitally, right? Because your eyes hurt, like your voice hurts, like speaking at a computer all day, like you don't actually want to linger. So I don't know if there's a way to you pointed out, sometimes you'd have like the chat going and you just drop 2 words in the chat for how you're feeling right now. Right. Like it's better than nothing. Right.
Right.
But it's not the exact same, as grabbing a coffee and walking to the next meeting together. Right.
Yeah. I think that people need to start thinking about the phone more. Like literally like, hey, let me catch you on the phone. Can you call me right before you're going to your next meeting? Yeah. I mean, I'm doing that a lot. Like if I'm in the car, I'm always on the phone and just catching up with people. And you know, it's just trying. And like, I have one client who said, hey, in anticipating this idea of phone, can we do our calls while I walk in the, my backyard? And she's got a forest.
Yeah. Oh yeah. The walking meeting. For sure.
Yeah. Walking meetings and on the phone. I'm like, yeah, of course. You know? So she asked for it. I'm like, of course we can. And so that's a little bit different. I'm just wondering about the efficacy or the whether people would do the pick up the phone after the Zoom meeting. I don't think they do because they're on to the next meeting. So they're, you know, everyone's having the up, you know, so you have to like have the, you know, 10 to 10:50 kind of meeting. So you do have a little bit of time in between.
Well, there's that. I mean, I wonder if others have this experience of at some point there's the side chat overload, right? So yeah. Like, let's say, you know, you and I are in this very important meeting. There might be Skype going, there might be the Zoom chat going, there might be like, you know, texts going, there's still emails going. And at some point as humans, it's literally too much to process.
Yeah.
And we've gotten to like, you know, peak efficiency or maximum efficiency and we can't sustain it. So I feel like both in this conversation about digital, but also in the conversation about showing up authentically and with love, we need to also talk about a conversation about boundaries.
Totally.
And I feel like it's really important to, you know, to acknowledge that love in the workplace doesn't mean you give things that you don't, you can't afford to give, right? And it also means creating kind of clarity around.
There's reciprocity too.
Yeah, and also just boundaries around, I find, you know, with the working from home and the digital, being really clear about when you will or won't take meetings and actually following through with it, right? People mm-hmm. might be surprised, like, well, no, I'm actually, you know, not available. You know, this is the time I spend with my children, or I'm not available. This is when I'm working out. And I think we have to honor each other's boundaries, but also be clear about what they are.
Yeah, well, I think part of the issue is that when one of the main reasons why this has been so difficult for people to transition and they're so burned out from Zoom is because there weren't boundaries in the first place. So now, you know,
right.
There was not boundaries in the first. So now we're trying to have boundaries around, you know, 10, I mean, I had 6 Zoom meetings yesterday and it was like, I'm like, oh my, I could tell how burned out I was from it. And that's the 6, which is by far the most I would do per day. It was like, you know, I'm going on vacation today, tonight. So I'm like trying to get everything in. Right. And like most people we work with have 8, 10 hours of Zoom.
Yeah. 10 hours of Zoom, about 16 different calls a day.
Yeah. Ability to process that is just, is mind blowing. So yeah, there is boundaries. I was interviewing some the other day and she said, you know, I'm getting texts and I'm getting things from the boss at like, you know, 10 o'clock at night and, you know, they shouldn't feel obligated to answer it, but they do.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't think we could do what Portugal does. I don't think we'll ever be able to do that. You know, they just instituted like, you can't hear from your work after like 8 o'clock or something. Like it was like, wow, that's pretty cool. That's pretty interesting. So let me stop a second. We're about halfway and we have a couple of people on the call who might want to ask a few questions or just be involved in the conversation. So the people that are on the call, anybody want to jump in here?
Hi, Sue. Amelia, thanks so much for all this great information and, you know, kind of love, or I think sometimes people talk about heart, right? Kind of revealing their heart or knowing, even noticing that themselves have a heart. are there some cultures that make that easier or harder? Some company or organizational culture that makes that harder or easier?
Oh, wow. I mean, I feel like that would be like a good research question for another book about kind of comparing the two. But I would definitely affirm, Michael, the point around equal parts head and heart. And I felt like that was something for me that was a really big learning that I kind of shared in the book, that it's almost like if you're just engaging people's heads, they're running at half speed. But only when we kind of engage people's hearts with whatever it is that they might be passionate about, do we have like that full potential to flourish. So I definitely believe that. I guess I'm trying to think about, are there characteristics that lead to greater flourishing or greater love, greater ability to kind of show up at the heart? My hunch is that this is the kind of thing that does start at the top with the kind of the leaders sort of setting the tone. And that's why I do believe a lot in humanizing leadership and kind of leading with vulnerability. Because I think if you set that tone, then you're much more likely to get it back than, you know, leaders who make it seem like they're perfect and everything around them is perfect. it's much harder to measure up to that, right? So then we feel like we can't show up with our authentic self. So I think particularly for folks who might be listening who are in those leadership positions, there's a lot of power in leading with vulnerability and humanizing ourselves as leaders.
Yeah, if I can just follow up, your talk about worth really struck me. There's a woman that I work with at a very tough culture, I would say, a company I hadn't heard of before, but turns out is a global zillion-dollar real estate type of company. And I don't want to overgeneralize, obviously, but I think real estate's kind of tough.
In terms of specific cultures? I mean, I imagine financial services is particularly...
Yeah, exactly. And so she feels unworthy some days. And I just really wanted to appreciate you highlighting, kind of saying to me or other coaches or consultants, yes, worthiness, let's really be okay about talking about that and focusing on that. I think sometimes people get a message in some cultures, we pay you a lot of money. Right. That's how just we're telling you. Yeah. That's all we're... That's enough. Now back to work.
That happens a lot. People suck it up because they're getting paid so much.
Yeah. One thing that you kind of put your finger on too is the role and value that a coach or a mentor can have in helping people to feel worthy, but also to cultivate their own sense of worthiness, right? Particularly when you're in an environment that is really not supportive, because we've all been there, right? And we can talk about it from the perspective of different intersecting identities, right? If you are in an environment where you are Black, brown, gay, fill in the blank, and you feel like that is not supported.
She's an Asian female, Asian American, Pacific Islander female, born outside the States with an accent.
Right. Right. And so that's, and I think just making it more discussable that if you're not sort of measuring up to what is considered to be kind of normal in the kind of corporate environment, that there's always going to be those questions of, am I worthy? Do I belong here? One of the things also in the research that we found was really interesting about the extent to which people feel like they're spoken over in meetings and how the interesting thing there was for men and women, it was actually about the same, the more junior they were, 18 to 24, it was about the same. Like, okay, that's interesting. It's not just a female thing, right? It's not, men and women would have it equally. But what was interesting is that the likelihood to be spoken over for men dropped around age 35, but for women, it doesn't drop until age 55.
That's interesting. That's really interesting data.
And it goes back to, you want to be heard. Yeah. And to what extent do you feel like, and particularly with an accent, do you feel like your voice is heard or not?
Thank you so much.
Boy, I've got so many thoughts about all of this, given getting older and reflecting on life. And here's just some thoughts, whether you agree with it or not. Again, I'm a corporate psychologist. I believe over the years, working with a lot of people, that most people don't have high self-worth, that they don't, and I think a lot of it is because of what we're talking about in this call, is that you don't have time to kind of catch your breath and just to be with yourself, So what I talk in my own life, I'm kind of the gentle provocateur. I'm not in people's faces, but I come up with, a different take on things. And so a lot of my clients, I'm not seeing that many people right now, but I'm really talking mostly about love. And I bring it into almost every conversation, hopefully appropriately. And so many people are receptive to it. And I have had CEOs, because of our relationship and the trust, tell me that they love me, And I don't frame it so much as it's almost like it's got to be caring, or it's got to be empathy. I did a workshop in the wine country one time, and someone said, the L word, somehow it was the F word.
It feels like it can be very loaded. I get that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I take your
a couple other real brief thoughts too, is years ago, I was doing these stress workshops all over the world, and I got invited to the Sorbonne in Paris to do this workshop on how to overcome insomnia, the workshop guaranteed to put you to sleep, because I was working with so many clients, who was still a huge problem with sleeping. After the workshop, I went to this restaurant. I think it was before I was married, and I just observed, and I thought, this is really amazing. People are sitting and savoring their meal. Nobody's running off to the next gig. The waiter's not coming up and we need the seat. And it was a time of the French paradox. It was about the wine. Is that what's really, curative for people? So I won't go into all of this, but what I've come up with, you know, is basically that other cultures, and certainly when I was in France that time, is people work to live and we live to work here. I mean, that is every, what I, this whole conversation seems to be about that.
No, absolutely. I mean, and it is absolutely true that we do, from like a US labor statistics, we work more than any other culture and more than any other time in history.
And the happiness
what
scale,
is that doing to us?
We're way on the bottom, you know, right?
Yeah. And so so that's why I feel like taking the time to, you know, cultivate self-love, cultivate self-worth, understand the difference between self-love and self-care, right? Even like, because there's the whole industry around self-care. You can get yourself a haircut, you know, take a bubble bath and still not feel self-love, right? Like self-care is not the same thing as self-love.
Yeah. One thing I talk about.
What's the main way that they're different? I'm sorry, Maynard. What's the one main way that self-love and self-care are different?
Self-care, the way I think about it, right? This is my perspective and I share it in the book. The way I think about self-care is these are they're acts you do to look after sort of your, you know, the necessities, right? Whether it's grooming, haircut, exercise, nutrition, these are sort of things that you can do, but that actually cultivating self-love is consciously speaking to yourself with words of kindness. So it's more than just the kind of those acts of self-care. It's that conscious, loving yourself like you would a friend.
So I want to pick up on that. When I was talking about self-care, I was including emotional and physical. So I think that when you're talking about your emotional self-care, you have to be talking to yourself. You know, you just like that's right. Part of it, right? So but I like the distinction that there is a difference. So. Like it. Maynard, do you have anything else you want to share?
Yeah, I was going to say is the most important conversation. Everybody talks about all these conversations with other people, but I really believe that the most important conversation, which is exactly what Amelia said, is the loving, kind, compassionate conversation that you have with yourself each day.
Yeah.
And most people don't do this. So how could you have self-worth if you think you're a schlep or everybody's better, they're comparing yourself to everybody else?
Yeah,
I wake up each day and I just say, Maynard, it's a great day. I love you. You know, I don't go to bed going, oh my God, you know, your life sucks or something. You know, right. So I think a lot of it has to do with your self-talk. And then what I talk about, you talk about lingering in my own being and with clients or whoever, I talk about a sacred pause. And I talk about, it's not this thing, I don't have time. Well, I have a 1 minute meditation. You can take a breath. You know, right. So I don't get into these arguments, you know, about, you know, I don't have time and I'm running off to the next meeting. You can close your eyes for a second and take a breath. You know?
Right. Very cool. Thank you. Thank you, Maynard. It's great to see you and thank you for your contributions, questions. So, all right. So I want to pick up on this, Amelia, about the self-love and self-talk. So, I mean, we've been talking this whole time, really, it's been 40 minutes about these are concepts. So. And we're pretty much in the same boat on it. I want us to be more specific though, actually even tactical around, all right, so somebody should be more kind to themselves. A lot of people get caught up in being an imposter. That's the imposter syndrome is live and well, especially now. Let's counter that and talk about how do we be kind to ourselves? What do we say to ourselves? What do we, and not feel weird about it? How do we show that compassion, you know? And sometimes it's a reframe of the negative we're talking about, the negative self-talk. And sometimes it's what I tell my clients is neutralizing it's neutralizing things so that it's like whatever is right now and it's okay. That's not really positive or negative. It's more like just that's what's going on right now. That's a very Buddhist way of doing it. So
the acceptance.
Yeah, it's acceptance. Yeah. So I'd like to hear from you some ideas around that.
So I would say a couple of things, and I want to come back to this idea of the imposter syndrome. So let's come back to that. But so I think in terms of very practically from a self-love and self-talk perspective, that's the idea of the inner critic, right? And we all, I think, talk to ourselves in a way that's way more critical than we would ever to a colleague, someone we didn't even really like. You know, then you add like a child and someone or someone who you love, and you just think like my inner critic still used to call me foolish girl. And you kind of like, I don't think I would ever say that to another, you know, a woman at work or any person. But like, why is it acceptable for my self-talk to be that negative? So I feel like one of the first things we can do is really tackle that. Like just listen to how you're talking to yourself. What tone are you using?
Write it down even.
Yeah. And like, so how, you know, what does your inner voice sound like? And the other thing I found is really funny is if you think about it, the words that we tell ourselves, we think that they're true just because we recognize our own voice, right? It's like, oh, like that must be true because I thought it.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I often try to do is challenge myself almost deliberately. And you almost feel this kind of grinding the gears of what if the exact opposite is also possibly true? And so I find that one of the things I try to do is I know exactly what insecurity sounds like and feels like inside my head, but what might the opposite start to sound like? What would I sound like? What would I say? What would I think? What do I do if I was acting out of security, not insecurity? Mm-hmm. And it's been kind of a fascinating little like personal like science experiment, Sue, because when I act out of security, even if I don't necessarily feel it in that moment, it's like, oh, well, security would sound like this. The results I get back are way better than if I acted out of insecurity. And so I feel like those are just
what is some actual self-talk of security that you
so say? Insecurity is this person hasn't texted me back in 2 days. What? They must not like me.
Right.
Security is
yeah,
exactly. Security is, hey, haven't heard back from you. Guess, you know, now you know, you don't have time to connect right now. Right. It's
right.
And then, busy. Exactly. And then exactly. And you have empathy for the fact that like, you don't know, like that person could have lost their phone. They could be, you know, suddenly like caught in like a huge kind of work commitment. So like, for, at least for me, the first reaction is like, oh, they're not responding. Right. Or like, you know, my email, you know, got lost and like they're. And so I think security has to do the, you know what, maybe it's okay to extend the grace, that your email, you know, may have gotten lost or the text may not have gotten responded to, and to, almost just to kind of flip it, to invert it, as opposed to, they're not responding to me or, you know, taking it really personally.
So back 40 years ago, you know, the whole affirmation, I have a book, I was just going through all my books in the last week, and there's an affirmation book, you know. So self-love and self-talk that's positive is, you know, a lot about affirmation. So do you have a particular practice that you do or you teach that others teach others? I mean, so this is, you know, part affirmations, part meditation. I mean, I don't really care what we call it.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the actual content of like, what is it that we're saying to each other?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I do, and I share in my book is just, it's, you know, you mentioned the Buddhist, it's the loving kindness prayer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just the meditation.
Yeah, I do the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe happy, maybe safe,
happy.
Maybe at peace. Yes. May your heart be full of love. That I don't know
it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so if there's any tweaks or variations on it, but the idea of some practice around loving kindness is important.
You say your version, and I'll say mine. It's almost similar. Say it. May I be happy. It's the first one.
So may I be happy. May you be safe. May you be at peace. And may your heart be full of love.
Nice. Mine's may you be happy. May you be healthy. May you be safe. May you live with ease. And may you be free.
Yeah.
And the free one is the last one is, you know, the hardest, especially right now. with our pandemic that's creating lots of boundaries, but there's some form of that, because there's no right answer here. It's like it's the idea of may I be happy, may I be safe, and then I say it for others. I'll say
right. So then it's extending it out.
Yeah, right. I'll say may Allison be happy, may Allison be safe, and then I say it with the people that I'm having a hard time with.
Right.
It's not just the people that are my, you know, my go-tos.
No, and I think you're right. I mean, that's absolutely important, because it's easy to love the people who are easy to love.
Yeah.
Right. And and it takes a cultivated practice to love people. And also to acknowledge that even if you're, you know, in a sort of a challenging situation, you know, with someone at work, they are, you know, son to some father, you know, father to some son. And it just humanizes people to be like, okay, well, they might not deliberately be trying to be, you know, annoying to you personally.
Mm-hmm.
So it humanizes, and I love your reminder that we can extend loving kindness to them as well.
Right. You said you wanted to come back to the imposter syndrome. So what did you want to say about that? And then we will.
What I want to say about that is I sometimes get asked about that in the relationship to kind of worth. And I do not believe in the imposter syndrome. And there's a really wonderful article that was written in Harvard Business Review. And I should, at this point, I should know the name of the authors, But I think they just did a really brilliant job of pointing out that, first of all, it's not a syndrome, it's not medical. So like, let's stop calling it that. Yes. Second of all, it was a completely manufactured, mostly for to make for women. And just one of my objectives would be to just like eradicate that from the dialogue and say, instead of talking about, oh, Sue, I think you're suffering from the imposter syndrome. It's like, why don't we flip that and say, hey, what would it look like for you to feel more worthy and more loved? What can you do for you to develop that practice? Mm-hmm. Who are the allies around you who you could cultivate to kind of help mirror back your worth and feel like you're in an environment that was, you know, let you show up authentically? Like, it's just a different conversation than saying you suffer from the imposter syndrome.
Right. I think that's great. I think that I just love this idea of how we can find more love, more worth, and more meaning in the workplace. Because it's not like the workplace is over here and then life's over here. I mean, it's everything's integrated, especially now. So yes. I really, really appreciate you being here. There's a lot of great overarching concepts and also certainly specifics about loving kindness, I think, are really important. So appreciate you a lot for being here and for taking the
time. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yeah. And you can get a hold of Amelia with her website, Amelia Dunlop, and it's dunlop.com. Her book is Elevating the Human Experience, Three Paths of Love and Worth at Work. You can also find her at LinkedIn, and you can also find her at Deloitte. So thank you again.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So everybody, we take a break in December for the holidays, so we will not be with you then. And so I want to wish everybody a great Turkey Day and however you celebrate the holidays in December. Everybody celebrates Happy New Year, so Happy New Year. We'll be back in January with Liz Weissman, who has been on our show, I think, twice already. She's like one of my go-tos. She's one of my favorite people. She's got a new book out. Thanks again, everybody. Have a great holiday. Bye.